Committee for the Special Committee on University Governance and Operations. As many of you know, we've had some changes. I want to welcome now Senator Dembro to the Senate side. He says he's taken a job to the dark side. It could be, I'm not 100% sure. But it does leave an opening on the House side, and so I am going to seek nominations for... I'm going to open an organizational session and seek a nomination for House co-chair. I'm going to nominate Representative Buckley. Is there any other nominations? Nominations are closed. Is there any discussion? I don't hear any discussion. Is there any objection to Representative Buckley being the co-chair? Representative Buckley is now the new co-chair on the House side. Congratulations, you lucky devil here. We are very efficient here.
I think Matt was going to vote no, though. He missed his note. He was raising his hands.
I'm going to close the organizational meeting, and I'm going to open an informational hearing on university shared services. All these gavels or something else. And I'm going to invite up to the dais Bob Davies and President Ed Ray.
Good morning. I'm Ed Ray, President of Oregon State University, Chair Girard. Chair Buckley, and members of the committee, it's wonderful to have an opportunity to speak with you this morning, and I think it's doubly enjoyable because I think we're making real progress in dealing with issues of shared services, the organizational structure to deal with it, and implicit costs of independent boards and of shared services, particularly to the technical and regional universities. And Bob and I are going to take a little bit of time to talk to you about that. I hope you got the slides that we made available to the committee. But let me just go through this fairly quickly because we really want to preserve as much time as possible for questions that you may have of us. We fully expect to get a report to you by the December 15th due date. For those of you who are concerned not seeing a stack of papers by our side, I assure you that based on the work we've done so far, we have roughly, in terms of the report itself, about an 18-page report and probably about 80 pages of appendices, so the nighttime reading certainly will be forthcoming. I want to, before we start, thank our presidential colleagues on the President's Council who've worked on this. Probably the most intelligent decision we made very early on was to ask the vice presidents of finance to figure out what it was we were in favor of. They worked with legal counsel, human resource directors, the OUS staff, who've been wonderfully supportive, and I think we would agree particularly that Jay Kenton deserves an extra merit badge when you get around to giving them out for the amazing work that he's done. We have a draft document that we're working on. In fact, we have a meeting later today. If the timing had been a little bit different, perhaps we would have been able to even share the interim report with you. But as I say, I think we're off to a very good start. Among the requirements of us were to recommend an appropriate entity to facilitate sharing of services among the public universities after universities with governing boards are established. In doing that, we looked at everything from outsourcing to nonprofit 501c3s and everything in between. And what we came to conclude was that we really ought to have a multi-party agreement using the available structure where members of the shared services agreement would provide services to all of the members on a fee basis, and that we would, to the fullest extent possible, try to make all of those shared services opt-in, opt-out on a voluntary basis. And I think Bob will tell you about at least one of the qualifications in that regard, if not more, that we're wrestling with, and that's why we're continuing to work on the report. But basically, we decided that for the sake of simplicity, that Oregon State University would be the primary provider of the shared services that we agreed all of us had an interest in, beyond the three that are mandated in the legislation for benefits and risk management and collective bargaining negotiations. Those are all stipulated, but we actually came up with a list of seven, which I thought was represented real progress, that we'd gone beyond simply what we were told we were going to share. And we agreed that, as I say, that we would try to use existing personnel wherever appropriate to staff those shared services activities. Some are housed in Corvallis, some in Portland. For simplicity, all of them would be OSU employees, but we would hire an executive director who would, in fact, have reporting line responsibility to the President's Council or to their designees. And I think some of us have thought about having our Vice President's Finance serve as a part of that oversight committee in our place. The preliminary conclusions that we've reached was to included dividing shared services into prime candidates for shared services, those that we thought, because of governance issues, needed to be handled on an institution-by-institution basis and therefore not good candidates for shared services, and then other services that needed to be dealt with. Just briefly, I'll stick with the prime candidates for shared services. As I said, employee benefits, risk management, collective bargaining, those were the mandatory requirements, but we've also agreed on accounting and reporting, fifth site computer operations, payroll processing, and treasury operations, cash management, investment, and debt financing. The next slide gives you an indication of so who's interested in partnering with respect to which services, and as you can see, the three required shared services are subscribed to by all of the institutions, and then there are some variations in the remaining four. For example, Eastern and OSU are part of three of those, and Eastern and the other technical and regional universities are partners in all four of those. And we feel pretty good about that. One of the things that one wants to know is, so what are the consequences if we're going from a system of shared services where everybody's in? Obviously, there are going to be consequences in terms of scale economies, cost efficiencies, that wouldn't be the same if you have fewer than seven in any particular shared service. So Jay and the Vice Presidents for Finance went through this pretty carefully and tried to identify the known costs before and after this shift from the OUS shared services arrangement to the proposed shared services arrangement, and calculate what incremental costs would be to the institutions. And for those institutions, OSU, PSU, and University of Oregon, that are establishing, hopefully, if the vote today goes forward, independent governing boards, what our costs would be, because governance does cost something. I think I've made that point more than enough times, and now we're going to try to calculate exactly what those net costs are. The last column in that slide indicates calculation of the incremental costs to each of the institutions from the changed governance reality and shared services reality that we face. And if you look just at the technical and regional universities, the sum of their net cost is $1.94 million. Now, as you can imagine, one of the things we're talking about, and I'll turn this over to Bob, he'll give you more of a sense of it, is it really does depend on what's in and what's out, and so and how some matters get handled going forward, PEB rates, for example, that could alter the calculations for individual institutions, and so we're discussing what are the appropriate numbers to bring to you. I've assured my colleagues that unless I'm sorely mistaken, you're going to ask DAS or somebody what they think of the numbers that we come up with. So these numbers are going to be scrutinized, I'm sure, very carefully before things get settled. But let me turn things over to Bob to go through some of our other recommendations and issues.
Actually, Jay, we might go back to that last slide. For the record, my name is Bob Davies, president of Eastern Oregon University. Senator Co-Chair Girard and newly elected Co-Chair Buckley, congratulations.
Thank you.
I wish we could run faculty senate meetings with that gavel as fast as we can. Before I start some of the formal comments, I do want to thank President Ed Ray for the leadership in this. This has been a very interesting group of working with the seven presidents. We have, in my 5 years here, and Ed, you've been here a little bit longer, we've never worked this closely together on a single focused project and have done so with a sense of collegiality, with a sense of purpose, with a sense of doing what's right. We were, in many ways, swimming along very, very, very well, and we have ironed out most of the issues and most of the concerns. Where we are right now is dealing with some very significant unknowns. As President Ray mentioned, if you add up the net annual cost, we do have a $1.9 million figure, which the true universities are out, for lack of a better word. And the important part about that 1.9, that is what we know now. This is given a sense in time. There are significant unknowns out there, and some of those things we talked a little bit earlier, PEB cost distribution and how PEB will be distributed and cost distributed after the biennium. There is a building student building fee pool of funds, and the dissolution of the three universities moving to their own institutional boards and leaving that student fee fund presents an interesting challenge, not only in the short term of how we work with that, but also longer term. Treasury services is another one where after a year or so the institutions may opt out, and that too would add additional cost to the institutions in terms of the ability for borrowing for projects and other services. There's also another program that's very important to the true universities, and that's what we call the Fifth Site. The Fifth Site is a computer that hosts all of our banner operations. It is operated currently at Oregon State University and has provided computer services for the four true universities along with the Chancellor's Office for the last 5 or 10 years, and it is funded by the true universities at a $100,000 a year rate, but a big portion of those funds is $2.0 million coming from the Chancellor's Office directly to that site. If that funding changes over the next 2 or 3 years, that represents a major issue for the true universities in adding cost. And so when we look at the 1.9 number, that is today. Correct. What we are very concerned about is what happens on July 1, 2015, and then moving forward. Just an all-in, if everything disaster happened and everything went out, that number is closer to the $4 million mark on an annual basis, in addition to some debt payments from the student building fund and those type of things. Those are the issues that the presidents are geared up for and are working on, and hopefully today at 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock, we're going to arm wrestle and see what happens, right, Ed? But again, I think the encouraging part of it has been a very collegial, very open, a very honest experience, and we're working very diligently on those efforts. So, Jay, would you mind using your magic finger now? As part of the report, we are to recommend mechanisms to mitigate or eliminate the negative financial impacts for the three universities. We are providing and are ready to provide the three recommendations with a target of the $1.9 million. But again, I want to make a caveat that that number could go up, and that is the reduction in funding for the Chancellor's Office operations as a number one choice. Their operations do change, that does present an opportunity to reallocate those funds. Reductions in the appropriations to the larger universities necessary to offset these impacts. And like good presidents, we never leave a table without asking for more money. So the third option is more state funding. On slide 7, this addresses the PEB distribution. Again, right now the PEB distribution is collected, and so out of the 7 universities, roughly half overpay, half underpay, just due to the PEB calculations and whatnot. The true universities have higher health care costs. There's an amalgamation of those reasons: access to health care, the risk pool that are on our campuses. We have more married employees with families, and et cetera, and so our costs are actually higher. But by being together, we are actually able to have the average cost for all the universities. And as this moves out, there is the potential that each PEB bill will be sent to each individual university, which would have a significant impact on the true universities. So again, we provide several options: adjust the rate so that each university pays its respective amount, and redress these impacts by seeking additional state general fund dollars and providing these resources mainly to the technical and regional universities, or leave the composite rate as is and just keep moving forward, and then reallocate existing general fund dollars to Portland State, Oregon State, and Oregon, as they are the ones that are typically overpaying.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Bob, there is at least one more option, right? I mean, one could keep the composite rate and just keep the composite rate. There are not legal impediments to doing that, are there?
No, there are not.
It's a legislative decision. No.
It is a legislative decision. And there is a fourth option. We, as a system, 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, I looked to Jay for clarification, as Senate Bill 242, I do believe, passed, we did talk about having the universities leave the PEB system and become self-insured or seek other insurance opportunities. At that particular time, that request was denied for very good reasons, but that is also a fourth option. Do I need to move?
Oh, have a sleep here.
I have talked to some of the people within the various universities about some of these estimates. And the one thing I'm wondering, and I think PEB is an example of this, probably one of the better examples, there is a difference between increased cost and shifted costs. And while it's an increased cost to the regionals, some of the regionals, it's a decreased cost, actually, to some of the larger institutions. So it would seem to me that internally, you would be just reducing the amount of funding going to a larger institution for this particular purpose and increasing the amount that might be going to a regional. It has the same actual impact in the end as having a composite rate. I think the whole issue about PEB has been around for at least a decade. But I just think some of these costs, as you look at it, some of the other categories President Ray demonstrated, may actually demonstrate additional costs that are not in the current system. Some of them are merely just shifted costs within
right.
the system.
And I think we took our charge as including trying to sort out what are the inherent subsidies in the way shared services are managed now, call them out, and to the extent one would want to remedy those as part of the process, at least be explicit about them. So, for example, with the composite PEB costs, the largest subsidy really is from PSU. It's about $875,000 a year. And so the question was, I mean, you could say, deal with it, and then we would deal with it. Or we could propose, you know, other ways in which maybe the subsidies ought to be eliminated, either by reallocating existing revenues or if additional funds could be made available. But telling us to keep the composite is certainly fine, and then either dealing with the implicit subsidy issue or not is also really at the discretion of the legislature.
Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
It had been my previous understanding from the issues around the system leaving PEB that while that was not permitted during this biennium, and there is statutory language not permitting it, I believe, in the bill, I do anticipate the issue will come back. And if you're a true allocation of costs, your costs probably as a composite of institutions would be less being outside of PEB, mm-hmm. but the cost for the state, for its agency side, would be greater.
Right.
So,
which is why it remains an issue rather than something that's been resolved.
and what you point out is clear in this very issue of just seven institutions, very clear of how the accumulation or the amalgamation of that is very real. So I do realize if we did pull out, it would have downstream or cross-stream implications.
Any other questions?
Moving on.
President Davis,
so thank you. And moving on, as I mentioned, we do have student building fee. That's just so that everyone knows, starting in 1961, the student building fee pool was created through statutory requirements, statutory legislation, in which every student at one of the seven universities pays $45 per term that goes into a student building fee, and this allows for all the universities to utilize to lower bond payments, to lower bond ratings, interest rates, and also very much so allows the four technical and regional universities to use that as a source to conduct student-funded building projects, student rec centers, and the like. With the three universities going with their institutional board and becoming independent in that sense, they will no longer be paying into that reserve fund. Jay has created a very long spreadsheet that shows that there are shortfalls in that mechanism. The revenue from the true universities just are not able to support the debt payments going forward. So that is something that we are obviously very interested in making sure we make all of our debt payments. There is a $22 million reserve fund, and that priority one or option one would be to use that reserve fund to pay off all existing debts and over the time frame, and that would clear that issue. Number two, and also I need to do point out that the reserve fund is primarily due to the inclusion of Oregon State, Oregon, and Portland State. If it was not for those institutions in there, that would not be that reserve fund. So you can see the financial interest in my friend in having those resources either applied to these debts are returned to Oregon State. And so option number two would be to use an agreed-upon calculation and methodology that a portion of the reserve fund to return to those institutions and use excess balance, the larger an agreed-upon algorithm to make it all whole. And then the third option is to distribute all 100% of the pool reserve balance to larger universities now and then agree on an algorithm that will hold the universities true universities. universities hold until all the debts are eliminated. This, in my mind, handles it's a 20-year problem. This, in my mind, handles that 20-year problem, which I would call short-term, believe it or not. The challenge that the true universities see going forward, however, is out without this pooled fund, we will be in a very interesting position of how to fund and finance future student fee-funded buildings. That's going to be a challenge that we will have to analyze and look at, and there is no easy solution at this particular time, and one that is actually beyond the scope of this project.
A couple questions on this. Would the $21 or $22 million reserve fund pay all the debt service for all the universities if it's left there, and without having to have any more income to that particular thing?
Yes.
Yes.
The reserve is $22 million, and this is the long table. It adds up to 17.6. If you just accumulate it. So the money is there to cover it, and Bob's concern, understandably, is beyond that point. There's an implicit cross-subsidy from the large university student fees that are collected, combined with the technical and regional university student fees that has made projects possible for the technical and regional universities. And if everything needs to be, if the decision is going forward, things need to be funded on a self-funded basis without cross-subsidies, there simply isn't the capacity at the technical and regional universities to be able to do much of anything through student fees in terms of capital projects. What's been making it possible for them to do things at a regular and needed pace is that there is this common pool that basically is oversubscribed to by the three larger universities.
Well, Cesar, we have maybe two issues here. We want to make sure that if the debt load is then distributed out, mm-hmm. that's going to be a real burden for the TRUs in a way. And then secondly, if we leave that fund to retire the debt, mm-hmm. Then future building, and then we divide it up. I mean, the fees go into the individual collections. The TRUs would also be in an awkward position, but at least they wouldn't have the debt load.
Yeah, and our position, and it's reflected, as Bob indicated, in our alternative recommendations, none of us think it's appropriate to simply say, you have a problem. We recognize that pool needs to be used to retire that debt. It's a common obligation. The only question is, does the pool reside with a common fund, or does the money get distributed out and then paid back on an annual basis by the large universities as well as the regional and technical universities? None of us believes it's appropriate to simply say this is not our problem. But there is the problem beyond today and incurring future obligations if the larger universities are no longer contributing to a common pool beyond July 1, 2014. That creates a developing problem for the regional and technical universities.
Senator Hansel, I do believe we have a very good set of recommendations, and the number one is probably the most simple, which is basically use the $20 million, retire the debts as they come due, and move forward. I think that as the technical and regional universities continue to work on our own various issues, we will be coming up with some notions and ideas on regards to how to create opportunities for future development. And it will be a challenge, and it will be a stretch, but we're also very creative individuals.
Senator Denbrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the way that you're dealing with this reserve problem. I think it's a good example of a consensus kind of way of looking at this. Looking forward, essentially what this would mean for the TRUs is that student buildings, student service buildings or things like that are currently being paid for through revenue bonds, you would have to come to the legislature for general obligation bonds. Is that right? I mean, it's not to say that those buildings could not be built. It just means
I think that's
they're going to have to rise up to the high level.
That's correct. There would have to be different ways of financing than we currently do.
Could be lottery ball. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I have a 101 question. So we pay off the debt, and we go our separate ways. What happens to the $45 fee? Do we continue to collect that from the students? And if so, how would that be distributed?
For the large institutions, they would no longer be under the statute. So they, as of July 1, 2015, they will no longer be paying that $45 into the fee. With regards to the technical and regional universities, we will continue to collect that $45 because there are debt obligations still to be maintained, and that $45 is going towards the retirement of our debts. For example, at Eastern Oregon University, we have just completed a renovation of our student union. The students themselves voted an extra fee themselves of $30 per term per student, plus the $45, so they're paying $75 towards that loan. That will continue until that debt is finally resolved. Beyond that, I think that it will be an interesting statutorial discussion, and it would also hinge upon what is the governance model for the technical and regional universities. But for the short term, those fees will continue to be collected.
Yeah, we expect to continue to collect the student fee after July 1 of 14, and given that the larger universities are cross-subsidizing the building fund for the regional and technical universities, obviously we're going to continue to generate enough revenue to support student fee-funded projects, revenue bonds, without having to come for general obligation bonds. The challenge is, beyond that point in time, how do the technical and regional universities secure sufficient funding to do student fee-supported, if not fully funded, projects? And it does require thinking about general obligation bonds having to be a companion piece, at least.
Or just a little extra generosity on behalf of OSU.
One can always ask.
So, Ed, you have lunch later on?
Senator Rivlin?
You gave me an opening. We tend to set debt policy in the state by on an ad hoc basis, not on a long-term basis. We've started to do it just this biennium in some ways, in that I think our days of using lottery bonds for any of the universities are somewhat limited, because we now have the new vehicle of Q bonds, which are in a sense general obligations of the state. But they don't require the 50% match. So a lot of the projects at regionals are now Q bonds. The big three are actually faced with a significant issue, though, too, because some of the core buildings on their campuses are not the types of buildings that you can go out and get a donor for to actually bring the building up to code to make it useful for a longer period of life. So there's a lot of issues out there. But within the statutes that were passed, going just a slightly different direction, the system and the universities were given the ability to issue obligations themselves. Mm-hmm. And just like a small city or a special district, I see no reason that if the students and if the administration of a smaller university had something that they wanted to issue revenue bonds for where people were willing to pay for it, that they couldn't technically be able to have such a vehicle, actually without coming back to the state for a general obligation or a Q bond. And I think, obviously, there's precedent in that, in the sense of at both of your universities, in a sense, the expansion of the health sciences area at Oregon Institute of Technology, some of the new classroom buildings at OSU. EMU at the University of Oregon. So I think all this needs to ultimately be worked out. But I think in terms of this, one of the issues that I have is there's two issues in terms of this compiling of funds so that you can move funds back and forth when you have an issue. And if you've got a smaller group of entities with smaller assets, you can't move funds back and forth. That's one issue. But I was wondering about a different issue that's come up, and that is the sort of routine investment of funds that are available. Now, obviously, the legislature basically gave you the authority not long ago to keep your funds, actually, particularly tuition funds, in terms of so that you had the earnings from those. But even with a smaller pool, although the earnings are not great, you know, we have literally dozens and dozens of entities may take legislation that participate in the local government pool through the treasurer's office. They get modest returns on their investments, but some local jurisdictions pick that option. I'm just wondering, most of these issues seem to be resolvable. They don't seem to be insurmountable.
I think that's right. There is a potential cruel turn of events here, though. I think it's easy to say that the larger universities could think about their borrowing capacity. We've started to look at it to float bonds to undertake important projects. The reality is it's a much bigger issue. I think one needs to look at the financial sustainability of the technical and regional universities and ask what's credible in terms of their borrowing capacity to somehow deal with these things on their own. It's a smaller part of a much bigger question, but I think it's a felicitous assumption that all they got to do is go out and borrow. I think they would be under great stress to do that.
But also to your point, there are a lot of different options, and we are very creative people. And most of the issues that we are encountering, we are finding solutions to. When we first started this, Ed and I had a discussion, thought this would be a contentious bout of boxing each and every other Thursday when we met. And we have been able to be, again, very creative of how we approach the issues, how we approach each single issue, but also in respect to the larger discussion. So I agree with you, Senator Devlin, that there are many options and we need to be creative in how we go about and tackle them. There are opportunities for us.
And to that point, I think both of us are pleasantly surprised. In each of these three areas that Bob's talked about, the presidents came to a common agreement about, in a prioritized sense, what recommendations would we make to the committee and to the legislature for dealing with each of those three issues, rather than simply say we were not able to provide any kind of counsel at all. We understand that this committee and the legislature will decide how these matters get determined, but we felt it was an obligation for us at least to try to give some sense of our priorities in terms of dealing with each of them, and we were able to do that, I think, which is a good result.
Any further questions? President Davies, do you have any more?
I know we've got lunch, but I got a little bit more.
Okay.
One of the key things that I mentioned earlier, that all of these ideas and solutions, as Senator Devlin referred to, we are being very creative. But a lot of this also hinges upon what will be the final governance structure for the true universities and how we will continue to work together and move these forward. There are, again, amazing opportunities, and we are working together to deal with these. The numbers that have been presented are that, in fact, point in time, and we need to keep that in reflection. The final element that we... Sorry, Jay, I can go up and down. The final element that we talked about is what is the recommendation in terms of shared services moving forward. And this is a very interesting one. Philosophically, we believe that the opt-out option is probably the best way to go. But realistically and practically, we have concerns about that, and that is a divergence between the universities at this particular time. As I mentioned, there's a list of shared services that are there. If all of the big universities opted out of those on a single year, it would be a very interesting challenge for the true universities to manage. And so while philosophically It's, you know, it's kind of the American dream that you have your own destiny and choose your best deal. We do have concerns. The model that Ed talked about with the shared service enterprise is built on the foundation of providing valuable, value-added services at a very reasonable price. And in doing so, we hope that we'll be able to offer the best deal. But at the same time, there are other universities may feel that they can find something better that more suits their need. And so one of the things that the true universities are struggling with is the language with this opt-in, mandatory opt-in, opt-out philosophy. Again, foundational, philosophically, we understand that, but how we put that into practice is something that we will be arm wrestling at 1 o'clock today. Representative Smith?
Representative Smith? Thank you. I have another one-on-one question. Committee members, I apologize. I've been recently appointed. New conversation for me. Can you explain to me why we call our smaller schools true universities?
Because we are true.
Okay.
The technical and regional universities. Technical meaning the OIT, the regional. Yeah.
Everything needs an acronym.
Yes. my preference was Fab 4, but that just didn't look good in legislative mandates and that type of thing. But it's the technical and regional universities.
All right.
Sorry, Representative Smith.
I'm new to policy stuff.
Yeah.
All right.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, when you talk about the opt-in, opt-out idea, do you envision that to be on a yearly basis? I have this concern that you opt in for the academic year of 16-17, and then somebody opts out for 17-18. What does that do to the other universities? Are you looking at that kind of flexibility?
One of the things that we're looking at on a service-by-service would be an actual contract. And there would be due notice and those type of things. So you do have some notice to play out. But there's still ramifications. Even if risk management, for example, liability insurance, property insurance, all those different types of things are built on that sizable and sustainable pool. And so if, hypothetically speaking, if all of a sudden Oregon State, Oregon, and Portland State found a better deal and decided to opt out within 1 year, roughly speaking, a $1.3 million premium increase will be at the true universities the following year.
Correct.
So there is some buffer, but even then, for a technical and regional university to absorb that within that one period of time, even with planning, could be a little bit difficult. So those are the things that we are wrestling out, and how would not only the notification of that, but then also the fiscal impact to the other institutions be managed and those type of things. Is that fair, Ed?
And then on top of everything else, you may have 7 independent boards in 2 years, and most of this conversation will be quite beside the point.
And on that note...
Well, again, if I could just follow, I mean, beside the point, unless you come forward with a proposal on how an opt-out, opt-in type of process might work, and we put in statute certain parameters around what is available for a local board to decide, I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that we'd say... any of the universities, that, you know, we give you the right to all of a sudden make this decision because it's a better deal for you, no matter what the impact is on the universities.
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me.
And we understand.
I don't think that's what your intent would be.
Yeah. No.
But I do take your point.
Yeah. No, as Bob said, you know, I think in principle we all agreed very early on we prefer a voluntary opt-in, opt-out system, where essentially people are buying services they value. They're not compelled to buy services, but certainly, particularly for the technical and regional universities, as one tries to contemplate all the states of the world that could emerge out there, it's really hard to say that you don't require yes, but. And it's the butt part that we're continuing to have conversation around.
Right. And it's just a quick follow-up. I mean, in some ways, it's similar to the problem we have with ESDs and school districts. Mm-hmm. We have the same sort of dynamic that happens, and trying to find out what that process is to make sure that the smaller school districts are not impacted by the decisions of the larger school districts within the ESD. Mm-hmm. We go through the same dynamic. There is a way to get it done. Goodwill is definitely part of it. I appreciate the goodwill you're bringing towards it. But we also have to have clear parameters going forward. So what the process is for opting in and opting out has to be clear.
Sure.
Senator Devlin has a very short, concise question.
Yeah.
Was that the question?
No, I think the hearing's going on a little bit longer than the chair would like. But I can understand why the big three might want the opt-in or opt-out voluntary. I can actually understand why the regionals, if the big three are going to have that, want the same thing because they want to be treated the same. But what I can't understand is why the three regionals and technical universities don't band together amongst themselves and say, we are not going to opt out because we believe it's in our best interests as regionals to keep what mass we can at a minimum of the three regionals and the technical university.
Senator Devlin, I think that is a phenomenal point. And in addition to the services that are listed in slide 3 or 4 with the mandatory or the shared services, we have identified other shared services that we are in fact going in on our own and creating our own shared service pool of services. We do believe that working together, regardless of what government structure is forthcoming, by working together and creating that mass, that we are tied together, and so we are creating that very, very pool. So I take your point. The four universities take your point very, very seriously that we are banding together. What we're looking for in this opt-in, opt-out language on these larger issues is a better solution that would help protect us. We understand where the bids are coming from, just as you do, but at the same time, we are looking for that fiscal and financial protection.
The student fee building fund is instructive because what it makes clear is it's not sustainable to support student fee-funded building for the technical and regional universities, even if they're all still in. So if you look at the 7 on slide 4, every one of those has one or more of the larger universities participating in it, except for the fifth site, which has always been a program for the technical and regional universities. And one could easily suspect that if the one or two larger universities pulled out of those other services, even with the four staying together, the cost implications would be pretty serious for them, that it would really add to their incremental costs substantially. So there's always this issue, I think, in the back of everyone's mind, is there at least one or more of the larger universities that are engaged in whatever the common activity is that makes it financially sustainable, because it's not financially sustainable without an infusion of funds if it's only the four. And so while I think the four would always want to have the same rights and privileges of everyone else, they also understand that in very specific cases, if you literally let everybody decide to opt in, opt out, there may be some circumstances where the four together just cannot sustain a shared service.
The opt-in, opt-out language is not to the benefit of the technical and regional universities. I will state that.
I think that's what the senator is getting at.
I will state that very clearly. We are not opting in and opting out, but we do understand our big brother's predilection. We do understand that, and we are trying, just as the big universities are trying and doing and understanding the issues that we face. It is one of those elements that we need to wrestle and come to terms with. We have, as a philosophical decision making process, when I was here a month ago or whenever it was, you asked how do we make decisions? We do votes or whatnot. We could do that, and we would win 4-3. And I don't know if that's been pointed out directly, but it is. But at the same time, we don't want to necessarily operate in that manner. We are trying to work through a collegial and consensus part. We do are very strong in attempting to work together in these efforts. And this is one of those areas that we're just going to have to buckle down and see how we can make it work for all of us.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Thank you, Mr. Kocher, and then I'll try and keep my questions to a minimum in the future. Again, I'm new to this committee. When I look at bullet point number two, it talks about the shared services. And my current paradigm that I'm seeing is that the smaller universities, the TRUs, would utilize potentially services from the larger.
Hmm.
The question I have for this committee, I guess, is why can't we shift that paradigm and require the largers to utilize the services of the smaller and thereby bolster up our smaller universities?
Yeah, well, actually, when we talked about so who ought to do what, it really came down to a function of who has what operational capacities,
right,
and to what extent could they be extended in as cost-effective a way as possible to other partners in a shared services enterprise. So this wasn't, you know, I want mine, you want yours. It really was a matter of talking about where are the staff that in all probability we would want to employ who are already in OUS, where are they located? We have a huge presence of OUS staff at in Corvallis. There also is a group at Portland State University, and that's what led us to think about who has the capacity to provide these services at the margin in a most cost-effective way.
And just to follow up, I think I understand that,
yeah,
but what I'm sharing is if we had an opportunity to bolster Southern Oregon University by having U of O and OSU and PSU seek services, shared services from Southern, bolstering the small university, why couldn't we look at that?
Well, I think it's going to cost a lot more, and you would have to compel us to do it, and you could do that.
Right.
And it would cost everybody a lot more money, and I think if you want to bolster Southern Oregon University, you ought to give them more money to support student enrollment and student graduation.
I'm just trying to figure out my paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, you can do a lot of things if you got the power to do it.
Actually, I would like to put my two bits worth. I've been pretty quiet here. It seems to me that the individual universities, and the bigs, Oregon and Oregon State in particular, if you vote what's truly best for the school with your own university, it might not be what's best for the system as a whole, specifically if you want to call them the TRUs or the regionals. And I'm really disgusted with the seven services that were contemplated to be shared. The University of Oregon has only committed to the three that are statutorily required. Again, to me, they're voting what's best for their university, even though they promised us if we'd give them this autonomy that they would be good actors. So I think Representative Smith is on the right track here. What's good for the state and what our obligation is to furnish what is absolutely the best for the state. You know I love Oregon State, but there are times it needs a kick in the butt. It's just the way that it is. So I do think that we do need to maybe force actors to be better actors with the bigs. That's my own personal
opinion. Senator, this is a problem we have because the legislature approved legislation to create institutional boards. I have been explaining for several years why I didn't think that was in the best interests of the people of Oregon. What I can tell you, and I do control, is that Oregon State University, in fact, doesn't just think about itself. We are trying to figure out how we can work with our colleagues as collegially and effectively as possible to make sure we don't promote our own self-interest above the interests of the state. And I think you see evidence of that in what we've talked about here, certainly in terms of the building fund, where our recommendation is that there are funds there that one could argue in a historical sense represent accumulated subsidies from the larger universities to the technical and regional universities, and we all agree the right thing to do is to meet our collective obligation, and that means that those funds need to stay there or on an annual basis come back, and we're looking for solutions like that going forward. in a number of other areas. We've also, in our discussions, talked about the resources that are available to the Chancellor's office, and obviously those resources are going to be needed going forward, some perhaps for the HEC, some perhaps for a new governance structure in place of the current operations of OUS, and maybe some of it could be available to meet the incremental cost needs of the technical and regional universities. And the larger universities are fine with however those resources get devoted, understanding that there are incremental costs for the technical and regional universities that are likely to come out of this process.
President Davies, you want to wrap it up?
And with that, it's a wrap. We, I understand that you have a lunch date, so I'll be very quick. Again, we as a seven university presidents are working on this very, very hard, and you bring up a very important part of how we have that balancing act. The opt-in, opt-out language is a fulcrum of that very, very issue. The true universities, to Senator Devlin's discussion, we are banding together. We do see the need to do that, and we will continue to do that, not only on these shared services models, but also as we have a further discussion on the governance, which is next on the agenda, about how we are working together and communicating and trying to do what is best for all of the Oregonians that we serve.
Any more questions for this panel? Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a informational hearing on
Thank you.
Governance of technical and regional universities. President Davies, you can sit there. You're up next. And Matt Donegan.
Senator Gerard, I just saw a young lady walk in with a Cal Poly Pomona shirt on. I need to go give her an Eastern Oregon University button. If you
Actually, we're Senator, these are students, I think, from the school that Ben Cannon used to teach at, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
I'm recruiting students all the time, sir.
For the students who just came in, thank you for coming. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Who wishes to start? Go ahead.
I've just recently swapped hats, so I'll go ahead and wear the hat as a presenter.
Well, you've been rather quiet up here.
Saving my breath. Good morning. For the record, I am Matt Donegan, and I am speaking as president of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. Chair Gerard, Chair Buckley, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. Let me start by extending the board's appreciation for the September 30th letter we received from the Joint Committee co-chairs and the governor, which specified your expectations for our board regarding the governance of the state's technical and regional universities. The charter you provided has been extremely helpful in focusing our board's efforts on behalf of our students. This morning, President Davies and I hope to demonstrate that OUS is being responsive to your September 30th letter and that we are on track in meeting the goals identified. I will describe the process that we've undertaken, and President Davies will then provide a progress report, and I will finally conclude by sharing some of the preliminary findings and considerations from the work underway. It's our goal that we will use our time this morning not only to communicate to you our progress and our process and progress, but also to hear back from you, your feedback and comments, to inform the remaining work that we have in front of us. So I mentioned the September 30th letter. It's in your packet. And if you reference that letter, there are several excerpts that I'll highlight. The letter first instructs our board to develop five-year business plans for each of the four true institutions. Instructs us that the leadership of the four institutions should actually provide leadership in the development of the plans in consultation with stakeholders. The letter says that the process does not presuppose any particular answer, but rather provides rich evidence, rigorous analysis, and significant levels of collaboration with affected communities, and then finally should move, quote, as quickly and deliberately as possible to a resolution. The board has developed a process and timeline to deliver on these five-year plans for each of the four institutions, in keeping with the September 30th letter's instructions to do so by February 2014, and we have a process that also meets the letter's other key provisions. I'll now highlight the key elements of the board process before turning it over to President Davies. The first step that we've taken is we have sanctioned a newly formed university governance work group. It's met twice, along with the true campus leadership, and it will continue to meet approximately monthly between now and the April 4th full board meeting of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. At the April meeting, the board will vote on any petitions from the true schools seeking institutional boards in conformance with Senate Bill 270. It will also authorize the development of a special report by our work group to this joint committee detailing our findings and recommendations regarding true school governance. And we will have that report ready for this joint committee by June of 2014. I would just say that our timeline is included in the packet of materials that we forwarded along. So the second item that we've done is we have developed business plan outlines. The outlines are also included in your packet of materials. You will see that this envisions a bottom-up and empowered approach, as your September 30th letter requested. Of note, as you look at the business plan outlines, you'll see a very central figure is financial sustainability. That's obviously appropriate, given the aftermath, if you will, of Senate Bill 270 and a lot of the issues that have just been discussed. There's a lot of financial movement among all seven schools, but certainly of the true schools, and so we're trying to recast our financial sustainability and then really look at the governance recommendations in light of a financially sustainable business model. Next on our progress is we have received we identified pretty early on that there was a lot of confusion around the different governance models that are being explored. What does affiliation mean? What is a branch campus? What is a consortium, et cetera, et cetera? And given all the varieties of the different governance models employed across the country, we retained a nationally recognized expert, the Association of Governing Boards, to help our board as well as the legislature and the remainder of the state to really gain a common definition of what we're talking about here. And so you'll see that AGB report, it's 13 pages. I think it's very informative. That's also in your packet of materials. So in conclusion, we received the report, or excuse me, received your letter. We got moving. We have a process underway to meet your goals and deadlines. And now I will turn it over to Bob to talk about exactly where we are in this process.
President Davies, I don't want any questions. We're just we'll question after he is finished.
Oh, okay. Coach Gerard and Coach Buckley, thank you for the opportunity today to talk about regarding the process and progress of EOU, OIT, Southern, Western, are the true universities, are undertaking to make a recommendation on behalf of our universities to the State Board of Higher Education and ultimately to this committee regarding the future governance structures for our universities. Through our separate and distinct missions, we, the TRU universities, contribute significantly to the educational attainment of our citizens. Together, we represent 20,000 Oregonian students, and we have the physical capacity to expand. We also offer a breadth and depth of programs to meet state and regional needs, and we have a commitment to rural as well as urban students, and especially to underserved populations, who are a significant contributor to the state's 40-40-20 goal. We are also key partners with businesses, community organizations, government, and other educational institutions in solving problems, fostering innovation, and creating economic growth in each of our regions and throughout the entire state. At this time, we are operating in a very ambiguous state of affairs. We face significant changes in state funding models and structures. The communities we serve throughout Oregon are in the midst of considerable demographic shifts. Technology and its impact is transforming the way we do business and access to higher education, and the state and global economy is impacting our regions very differently and in profound ways. And, as you all know, we are emerging from one governance model to a new government structure that is in the process of being defined, articulated, and composed. To say we have a lot of balls in the air is truly an understatement. As I am a firm believer, as I have testified to this committee and other committees before, that structure and form follow strategy and goals. It is important to know that the four TRU presidents wholeheartedly support the governor's vision for a seamless educational system and powerful collaboration with K-12 and community colleges, as well as other public and private universities. We are also ardent supporters in achieving the 40-40-20 goal, not only with our proportion, the 40% with bachelor's degrees and higher, but also for the 40% with associate degrees and certificates, as well as the 20% with high school diplomas. I think all of our actions to date speak to that effort. As requested by this committee, we are working together to provide a set of recommendations for governance and for shared services that will enable each of our institutions to help ensure sustainability financially and preserve our respective core missions, the quality and innovation of our research and scholarship efforts, our academic programs, community and regional support, and critically provide opportunities for rural and underserved populations that do not exist anywhere else in the state. As requested by this committee and by the letter that Matt mentioned and that was signed by the co-chairs, our then co-chair, Representative Dembro, dated September 30th, the presidents of the TRUs are diligently working and researching governance structures under the process outlined by the University Governance Work Group that was just stated by Matt Donegan, who is chairing that committee. As such, we are all working on our business plans and following the guidelines set forth by the work group. We are on track to meet the deadlines by this committee, and ultimately, this will enable us to set a recommendation to be forwarded to this committee. I must say and point out that we appreciate the approach being taken that allows each university to be intimately involved in the process and have it come from the bottom up rather than a top-down approach. This is critical, as any change must be embraced by the university, its students, its faculty, its staff, its alumni, and community members to be very successful. To date, as part of this process set forth by the University Work Group, we have and are exploring the three options of models of governance, as Matt just outlined. It is important to note that while we are leading our business plans and doing this work on our campuses individually, we are also working very well collectively, the four presidents. Based on this process, ultimately, we do believe we will be able to provide a recommended and viable option that will continue to serve our current students as well as future students. Currently, we are all engaged in a communication process regarding these three governance models on our respective campuses and throughout the communities we serve. The goal through this communication process is to gain insights and input on these various models at a macro level and engage our stakeholders in the process. Our goal is to have these communication processes completed by the end of this month, and through this process, we are disseminating information, conducting surveys, holding open forums, and soliciting feedback on websites and a whole host of other activities. As a matter of fact, I was in Ontario two nights ago when the good representative happened to pop into my open forum where we were meeting with students at our on-site. He was fine. In addition to this, we have received and utilized the report by the Association of Governing Boards that Matt did mention in identifying potential advantages and weaknesses of the various models, and we are using that to how they would pertain specifically to our universities, as well as collectively to the TRU universities and the state of Oregon. Furthermore, both President Cullinan and I, at a recent meeting of some 460 presidents attending the American Association of Colleges and Universities, had to talk with a plethora of plethora of presidents. We have a gaggle of geese. We have a plethora of presidents from around the country to gain insights from our peers on the various models and variations that are being utilized throughout the country. This was extremely useful to have a very candid discussion with the presidents in the various models and having them talk about the opportunities and the challenges that they face. Furthermore, I have talked to one president of the Bigs about what it would mean for Eastern or the other universities to be affiliated with that institution. Chris Maples had a similar discussion with another president from the Big, and we are sharing that information with our peers at Southern and Western. In December, we're anticipating hearing more from the AGB on a consortium model, and also at this meeting, as directed by Chair Donegan, the TRUES will also be prepared to discuss a consortium model as well in greater detail. Again, we are moving forward with these opportunities with a very open mind. As mentioned previously, we're all working on our business plans by utilizing a template provided by the State Board of Higher Education to build out our various models and using the financial projections over a five-year time frame, and also using many other data elements, which include enrollments, graduation rates, degrees, and et cetera. Also recently, Matt Donegan offered the opportunity for an AGB consultant to work with the individuals in collecting and analyzing the data, and we are taking that consideration seriously. From this work, and while I must point out we have not reached any conclusions on a specific recommendation, collectively we are uncovering a set of principles that we believe should be the foundation for the governance models of the TRUES. And having seen Matt Donegan's comments, they go hand in hand with his recommendations as well. These values and principles include the importance of collaboration among the TRUES and other Oregon universities, to the point Senator Delvin raised in the previous panel, the need to maintain the distinctiveness of each of our campuses and our commitment to Oregon students in our respective regions, the importance of sharing services to ensure efficiency and to keep costs as low as possible for our students, the value of maintaining and expanding operational flexibility on each of our campuses, and the critical importance of being financially and programmatically sustainable. These will guide our continued efforts and engage and establish our thoughts and recommendations. While we do, in fact, work in very ambiguous and sometimes contentious times, we are committed to the process of research and exploration of these governance structures and possibly developing new ideas and on these models with specific needs and environment. We also sincerely appreciate, again, I must point out, the bottom-up approach. It would have been very easy for this committee or the State Board of Higher Education or somebody to say, here is your cookie-cutter stamp of model. Because we are given this opportunity, because we have been able to devote so much time and attention to this, we have some amazing ideas that we will be stringing together. To conclude, Chair Durad, to conclude, please know that we are working very hard on this endeavor. We are not leaving anything to chance. We are diligent in our research and committed to providing a set of recommendations that makes the most sense for our universities in serving our students and our citizens of Oregon, our current students, and most importantly, our future students. I'm confident that we'll meet the timelines presented and provide the State Board of Higher Education sound and reasonable recommendations that can be utilized in making the recommendations to you. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer. Oh, actually, I'm getting it back to you. I'm sorry. Back to Matt.
All in good time. Thank you, Bob. Very briefly, we've outlined that we have a process, and Bob's done a nice job communicating some of the progress. I thought it would also be helpful to conclude here by sharing some of the preliminary issues that are percolating up so that we don't surprise the Joint Committee in the months ahead. So we've got, I think, five preliminary issues that for perhaps for you to digest, and maybe this will be a good segue into the Q&A, because I think this will give a very current look as to what some of the issues are that we're hearing about. The first one is really to the paradigm upon which we're really upon which we're developing the analysis, and really the paradigm is that of student value, and what we're really trying to look at is the relationship between student success and student cost, and trying to say what is the governance structure that provides the best outcomes for students, student success, at a given level of cost. And so what I mean by that is what we'll do is we will identify what's the low-cost governance option, and then as we look at any incremental costs above that, ask, is that worth it to the students? Because ultimately this is going to come down to extra tuition for the students, and we're going to ask, okay, is there value there? So obviously there are limitations to that, the main limitation being student affordability. We could certainly build, you know, the Mercedes model with great student success, and great student success, and nobody could be able to buy it because we just price ourselves out of the market. In general, that's the framework, is to ask ourselves, okay, if it's going to cost more for the care and feeding of an institutional board, for instance, and ultimately the students are going to have to pay for that, is that going to actually accrue value back to the students and to give them a greater educational experience? So that's the paradigm that we're really honing in on as we look at the governance options. The second is perhaps to restate what you've heard a lot here this morning, which, and you'll hear more from here again, and that is just the plain fact that change is imminent. There is a default scenario, and the default scenario is the no-action scenario. A no-action could be maybe none of the true schools ask for their own board. Or another no-action scenario is that they ask and it's declined. And so you have what's basically the true consortium, and that's the default scenario. That's no action scenario. But by no means is that a status quo scenario. Even under, and we're going to hear about that more in the next presentation, even under the default scenario, we're talking about massive change. The departure of the big three, the creation of a true governing board, true school governing board, the potential for shared services that Bob and Ed just discussed. There's massive change underway, and so under any scenario, there's really not a status quo outcome. The third major issue that we're that in consideration is that there really are great differences between the true schools. Bob mentioned that we're not trying to do a top-down cookie-cutter approach because there really is no one-size-fits-all solution here. If you look at the financial situation alone, the four schools are in very, very different situations. If you look at the program offerings of the four schools, very different profiles. So we're really trying to build tailored business plans, tailored governance structures for the four, while also, as we've talked about a lot here today, also considering statewide objectives as well. So we're trying to balance that bottom-up tailored business plan approach with also a statewide strategy. The next issue is critical mass. We talked about that just a moment ago with shared services. The same issue applies to systems. And our business plan process does contemplate the very real potential that one or more of the true schools will ask for and potentially get institutional boards, and what is the spillover effect to the other two schools. And so there's a real chicken and the egg dynamic here to say, you know, what are the ramifications? And so if you look at the business plan outline, what you'll notice is in the very final section, it's recommendations. We're asking each of the true schools, what's your first recommendation, and then a backup recommendation, and that is specifically to anticipate, you know, what if one of the other schools gets gets its own institutional board? Then what? Then what do you think is in the best interest of your students? And then the final emerging issue, as I've already highlighted, is just the confusing definitions around systems, affiliations, and so forth. That was really the genesis and the impetus behind the AGB report. We're trying to develop a common vernacular around the state. I think, particularly as we're getting feedback from the communities, we really want the communities to be informed as to what are we asking them about. The AGP report, I really encourage you, if you haven't had a chance to look at it, it's extremely informative. I will say, I think the bottom line takeaway for me is that there are many, many varieties of systems, consortia, and multi-campus affiliations and so forth. And that ultimately many of which are successes and failures around the country, and really what the ultimate determining factor around success or failure is quite often just execution. And execution depending upon leadership and talent and personnel. And so you can have a great structure with the wrong leadership and execution, and it's going to fail. And conversely, you can have perhaps an imperfect structure with great leadership and great execution, and the students can succeed. So ultimately, I think what's going to get you know, my personal vote, and I think going to get a lot of weight within our work group, is what is the governance structure that that anticipates succession of leadership, including myself, including all those around the table, and says what is the long-term governing structure that provides the greatest accountability, oversight, and really ability for these schools to execute their business plans. So, in closing, thank you again for this opportunity, and Bob and I are here and look forward to answering any questions you might have.
We have questions. We're really under some time constraints, and I want to open it up for some others, but please go ahead, Representative Whitson.
I was wondering, on your five preliminary outcomes, student value was one of your points, and I was wondering how you're measuring student success. Is it jobs at graduation? Is it admission to advanced degree programs, or is it just numbers of students who graduate?
Yeah, it's a very good question. If you see in the business plan document, there's a whole section on outcomes. And there you can see the parameters that we're looking at individually, and then we'll have a composite look as well.
Representative
Buckley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, thank you for your work. I'm just curious on the sustainability question, how you're framing that and how you're viewing that. The state has disinvested in higher education for decades. Are you assuming we're going to continue that disinvestment? Are you assuming that we're going to start turning around? What's your assumption of the state's participation in the sustainability of these institutions? And will you be giving us, two-part, I guess, will you be giving us a feedback back? With K-12, for instance, in the budget process, we get a pretty clear idea what is a sustainable level where most districts are not laying off teachers or cutting school days or, you know, hopefully adding teachers to high school. The university system, we're not clear on that. Is that the sort of information that you're going to be?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's the central question, because depending upon what your level, what your assumptions are, I mean, that could actually justify different governance structures. Right. As I look back on 270, a big part of 270 was a reaction to the level of disinvestment and a desire to attract greater philanthropy and other non-state resources. In our financial sustainability models, which are fairly detailed, and I think have been extremely helpful, the base case assumption is one of current funding levels from the state over the next 5 years. Now we are we do allow for optimistic scenarios as well as pessimistic scenarios, and doing some stress testing to say under what what would be the reaction financially or the response financially to further disinvestment. But as a base case, until we're informed otherwise, what we're assuming is flat funding levels.
Thank you.
And let me add on to that editorially. Matt answered very much factually, reporter-like. Editorially speaking, investment in higher education is an essential topic. When we as an institution, we as a state, technically lose money on every organization that we instruct. When we have our cost of education, not the price, the cost of education is greater than what we receive in revenues, which is tuition plus state appropriation, we have a business model that is not going to be successful. I graduated from a pretty darn good business school, the University of Oregon, with my MBA program, and they beat into our heads, if you're losing per widget, you're not going to make it up in volume. And to many respects, that's what we're trying to do now. And so when we look at the investment part, that is something that's very, very critical to me. How does that overlay with governance? From the AGB report, a function of the governance structure is to be the advocate for the institution to the legislative and to other bodies. And so as an overlay to this discussion, we are looking at how are we represented at that various levels, and what is the best way to have that occur, singularly, collectively, whatever the model is. And each of the models has different strengths and weaknesses to that. And so the interesting part of talking with the AGB consultant, the interesting part of being at the ASCU meeting and having discussions through our athletic conferences of university presidents in these various models is how do we make that functionally work? And that is something that we're very, very, very keen on. And so, again, it's not lost in the discussion. Matt is right. We're keeping the status quo and going like that along those lines. But how do we fundamentally invest in education? And Ed says it best, and he's got the tenure on me on that one, and he puts it on the table, and I'm very appreciative of that. We need to invest. So thank you very much for the question.
You bet.
If I might add just very briefly, one of the advantages that we've identified from the outset on the formation of this joint committee, as well as this entire exercise, is hopefully this will create or elevate the discussion in the state around the true schools. And I think the business plans will really, really shed a lot of light on these very important variables. And I mentioned a special report that we will provide to this committee, and I think funding formulas is going to have to be a pretty central part of that report.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. But I thought we needed at first just a little bit
short
of levity. I somewhat disagree with Representative Buckley about years of disinvestment in higher education. We did have a ray of hope in 97, another one in 2007.
Yeah, those are 3 years.
And maybe 2017 looks good.
The glass is
so
half
I
full.
Just,
painful, but true.
One of the things I wonder about is in terms of, we've had all these changes, but I understand one of the changes basically is that ultimately when everything is set up, the HEC will decide on the distribution of funds between institutions. Obviously, a lot of factors are already taken into consideration in that. Obviously, an engineering program is more expensive than a program in philosophy in terms of the provision of it to students. We clearly take into consideration in K through 12 differences in the costs in providing education. So I don't really see, even though there is this history of disinvestment, and I mean there could be an assumption that if there's higher costs at a regional that it's going to be just borne out in tuition, I don't see any reason why the HEC wouldn't possibly determine that there is a higher cost but a benefit of having an institution, and that they might distribute dollars in a different way based upon the costs that the regional would experience. We only have one polytechnic institution. Clearly, and I'm not trying to be critical of any of the institutions because I think they all actually serve a purpose, but two of them that are really far portions of the state, there are a lot of students that if it wasn't for SOU in the southern portion of the state wouldn't go to college. Same is true in Eastern Oregon, to be quite honest.
That is true.
And maintaining an option for students for smaller universities is probably an option too, where some students would not attend a U of O or a PSU or an OSU. So I'm just wondering, in a sense, obviously the distribution is going to be through HEC, but why wouldn't they take into consideration differences in costs? Over half of this committee is members of Ways and Means. We don't just simply decide every single service that we perform gets the exact same dollar. We look at what the costs are and what the benefits are.
And this is
a short version.
I thought that was a levity too.
In retrospect, I should have included that in my list of kind of percolating issues, because you're exactly right. I mean, this is already the central part of the debate and in the conversation that we're having, and we're using the exact same paradigm that you're using with regard to engineering degrees and so forth. And really, if you look at the true schools, there's the regional component. There's also the small campus component, which is to say there are certain students that are just are going to have a much higher chance of success on a smaller campus environment. And then that begs the question, is the state willing to invest in those students in a small campus environment at an incrementally higher cost than the average student in the state? And I think we're going to make that case, and we'll start today making the case that the state should, and that an incremental cost for serving these these students that will thrive more at a smaller campus, that the investment is in the state's interest. And then you also mentioned the Polytechnic Institute, and I think there's a similar argument to be made, but more on a programmatic level, that those programs are incrementally costlier, but that it's a critical economic development investment for the state.
Okay, I'm going to just close it down with you two, but I am not going to hit the gavel. We have two presidents that have come quite a ways. I just want to make sure that they've heard an awful lot in the back of the room there. I just, the president of Southern and the president of OIT, do you wish to have a couple minutes at the dais to, I'll give you a lot of latitude and you can kind of tell us what you feel if you wish to do so, or you're going to pass. Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a different informational hearing.
Thank you.
On the options for the Chancellor's office, Matt, you get to apparently stay there again. You lucky devil. And fill us in on what you feel is the, where are we going to go with the Chancellor's office?
Okay. For the record, I am Matt Donegan, currently speaking as President of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. Chair Girod, Chair Buckley, members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity. Good morning. Paul Kelly was intended to speak here, and unfortunately Paul is homesick today. I'm filling in. And for the sake of full disclosure, I am not a member of the Governance and Policy Committee that Paul chairs, and so I'm not going to be able to speak at any level of detail regarding the committee's work. Fortunately, I do have Interim Chancellor Melody Rose here in the room, and Melody has been deeply involved, as has Jay. I'm not sure if Jay's left the room, so if you do have detailed questions, I fortunately have backup. This morning, I'd like to present the current status and thinking involving the Chancellor's Office reorganization anticipated on July 1st, 2014. I'm going to present the work that's been done to date, the remaining work ahead of us, and I would welcome your reactions and responses, again, to inform the work that's still ahead of us. I'm going to start by describing the goals of the reorganization. And again, the work that's been done to date. Number two, I will then summarize the body of work that we anticipate for the Chancellor's Office as we flip the switch on July 1st, 2014. And then the third is that I'm going to actually share some of the preliminary thinking on the organization, including the budget. I mentioned goals. Okay, so four goals identified for the reorganization. First and foremost is the governance of the true schools. This is going to be a startup on July 1st, 2014. If we do nothing else, we actually have to operate the four true schools, serve those students, and we are focusing all of our attention to that goal. And actually fairly excited about that, I should add. I think there's a bit of a startup feel about that, and really focusing our attentions on the true schools and their success. I think that's a very positive dynamic. The second goal is cost efficiency. Obviously, it's a downsized operation, it's downsized functions, downsized scope, and we should have a downsized organization and downsized budget that reflects that, and so that we can reallocate and free up funds for other investments in higher education. Number three is the third goal in 2014 for the Chancellor's Office is going to be remaining transition management. There's so much transition work underway to the HEC, to the Big Three institutional boards. Welcome. And so there's still a lot of mop-up work, if you will, as all the reforms in 270 take place. And then number four, to the extent possible, we want to retain the flexibility to have an organization that can implement in 2015. And what I mean by that is, given all the ambiguity around what Bob and I just spoke about, we're trying to anticipate what could 2015 look like. And we don't want to eliminate critical functions in the short term, only to find that a year later, we need those critical functions. So we're trying to retain some organizational capacity as flexibility in 2015. So those are the four goals that we've identified. In terms of the process, about a month ago, we tasked the Governance and Policy Committee to really to take this on and start their work. They met just last Friday, November the 15th, and they received an initial recommendation from the Chancellor's Office, which on an organization, and it was unanimously supported as a preliminary recommendation, but unanimously supported from the Governance and Policy Committee. So that's who's in charge. It's the Governance and Policy Committee. In terms of what they're doing, it's a bit of we're doing both a top-down or and a bottom-up analysis. There's the bottom-up analysis that basically is saying, okay, given those, given what the Chancellor's Office is going to be doing in 2014, what kind of staffing do we need? And then we're overlaying that against a national comparable analysis to say, okay, what are similar systems around the country? What kind of staffing do they have? And then also here within our own state, when you look at PSU and U of O and OSU, they obviously are governing governing entities themselves with a similar student body. If you look collectively at the student body of the true schools, it's about the same size as one of the large schools. What do they have in terms of staffing? So we're trying to do a little bit of benchmarking and reality checks and say, you know, are we too big, too small, or just right? And then again, doing more of a bottom-up analysis to say, what's the work? And then finally, I just say we expect we're doing a lot more due diligence. We've been at this for about a month, and we've got a few months left ahead of us, and there will be continued due diligence. And this is a fairly intense work phase. In terms of the body of work, you know, when we flipped the switch on July 1st, 2014, and we ask ourselves, you know, what are we going to be doing? I would just say in the context, you know, I just can't understand or overstate just the historic transformation and what that means. You look, we're launching the institutional boards of the big three. We're launching the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, perhaps launching a shared services enterprise, and then we're actually launching this true school governance. I mean, there's a lot of newness, and I should add, we're losing staff right now at the Chancellor's Office. I mean, you can imagine this is creating a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity. Recruiters note that. Other states have noted that. There's a lot of talent here, and we are losing talent. And not only that, we're getting almost a complete turnover of my board. Many of whom are going on to institutional boards, and so the amount of change, again, it's difficult to overstate. And I think Interim Chancellor Rose deserves to be commended in that she raised her hand on this several months ago and said organizational capacity. I mean, you know, somebody's got to be here to run things next year, and so we're doing everything we can to retain key personnel and also provide some sort of an orderly transition of the board function. In terms of the body of work, again, governance of the true school through the startup phase, completion of the true governance recommendation. I might, you know, remind the committee that there's actually a 15-month window for the true schools to petition for their own boards, and so, you know, no matter what work gets done between now and June 30th, there's still another year of policy analysis and potentially another request for a local board. I mean, this period of ambiguity by definition will persist for at least another year and a half, because no matter what we do this spring, there's still another year for potential petitions, and what happens for one group is going to have spillover effects for the other three. And so all four kind of by definition are in a prolonged period of ambiguity due to this 15-month window. And so the Chancellor's Office is going to have to be staffed to inform all of that policy work. And then the third is, again, just a lot of transition work underway. I've been very proud of the Chancellor's Office as well as our board, and I think the cooperative way in which we're trying to assist the big three as they start up their own institutional boards, establish their own autonomy. And so we need staff at the Chancellor's Office to be able to do that. I think the last thing we want to do is just, you know, leave the big three hanging out to dry as they're trying to build their own capacities. So with that context, I'll share with you the preliminary results of the organizational design that the Governance and Policy Committee saw last week. The first one is just the total staffing number. Currently, there's approximately 100 people working in the chancellor's office. The recommendation is to downsize that to 28. In terms of the breakout of that 28, that would leave 6 professionals in the executive office, 2 in internal audit, 4 in legal counsel, 8 in finance and administration, and 8 in academic strategies. I think this is all in the packet of materials that was distributed. In terms of funding, the budget would be reduced from approximately $11.4 million currently to $5.5 million. And again, I think the breakdown on those costs is also provided. And so finally, in conclusion, again, we've established an analytical process, trying to be rigorous about this. We've established what our goals are. We will continue to refine these figures, these preliminary figures that I've shared with you today, as we get better comparables and really start to benchmark a little bit more rigorously. But this is a starting point, and we're on track to complete our work in the months ahead. So with that, I will be happy to answer questions as I may, and ask for Melody and Jay to support those questions I can.
Senator Denver.
Thank you, Senator Durant. So first of all, I want to thank you and everyone, Paul, and everyone who's been working on this. Your attention to this, similar to the one in the previous presentation, I think is exactly what's needed, these kinds of rigorous analyses and looking forward. And, you know, I understand the real challenge of trying to get as many of these questions resolved as soon as possible to deal with the uncertainty that people currently feel in the Chancellor's office. You know, we're doing such great work. And I can't let today go by without just paying special recognition to Jay Kenton. I know, Jay, is this really going to be your last hearing with us?
No.
No?
I'll never go.
Yeah. Anyway, Jay has done such really important work over the years in a variety of institutions here in Oregon. Anyway, the plan that I see here is for essentially the 2014-15 year. And that is assuming that, so the governance function of the board and the chancellor's office is going to be with the Trues. But there's the board will also, the chancellor's office will still maintain the academic services, coordinated academic services for all 7 universities. Is that right? No, I mean the provost council and those kinds of support things. No.
No.
Thanks, Melody.
Thank you, co-chairs, Senator Dembro. For the record, my name is Melody Rose, and I serve as interim chancellor of the Oregon University System. And to your question, Senator Dembro, the simple answer is no. As of July 1, 2014, we will be turning over statewide functions to the HEC. And part of the lift that President Donegan described in terms of transition for this year, and I believe into next fiscal year, which is what we're planning for, is that transition. So we lend significant, I think Ben would confirm that we lend significant personnel and resources to this transition and need to assume that we will continue to do so to make that as smooth as we possibly can. So the academic strategies, the contracted academic strategies division that you see proposed for FY15, and I want to underscore that the org chart and the budget that follows in your packet is a one-year proposal. This is not a long-term governance suggestion from the Chancellor's office. So that function in FY15 will be to continue to serve our board around program considerations as it feeds up to the HEC, and also to continue the good work of coordination among the four, and to some degree continue and extend the coordination efforts that have been part of our repertoire for so many years, but consigned to the four. as you know, we have one campus going through some significant contraction and under a lot of financial pressure. And part of our support to these campuses is going to be ongoing that year.
That's excellent. That answers my question. And if I could just follow up. Yeah. So I think what we have before us then is very important, very necessary. We're obviously going to have to think beyond this next fiscal year, and there are, you know, just a number of tracks that we're hoping will come together. The question of the institutional boards for the TRUs, the question of, the future of the HEC, and, you know, the support offices within the HEC, et cetera. So from our perspective, the more we can work together on this to get through this as quickly as possible while reassuring the faculty and the faculty at all the campuses and the support services within the campuses that we really do value academic coordination across all seven universities, and we'll do everything we can to maintain that.
Thank you.
Sure, please. Representative
Witsit
first.
Thanks. I'd just like to say, regarding these university governance and policy work groups, as a member of this legislative committee, I'd appreciate a little closer involvement with seeing the agendas and hearing about the outcomes of your meetings each time, instead of just having a big report given to us at the end of the time. I think it's really important for all of us to be involved and to see what it is you're talking about, and what kind of conclusions you're coming to, instead of just giving us a report in February or whatever. So yeah, I'd request that.
We certainly welcome your interest and appreciate that, and it's an oversight, and we'd be very eager to share that.
Thank
with you.
Thank you. Very quick. So on the funding summary that you gave us, am I reading this correctly that for the 13-14 academic year, you have $8.5 million worth of resources, but expenditures of only 5.5? I'm not quite sure I'm reading this correctly. And are you asking us for additional funding for the next academic year? I'm not quite sure what this summary means.
Co-chairs and Representative Buckley, thank you for the question. So I believe you're looking at the table at the bottom of the document.
Correct.
I want to make sure I'm looking at the same thing that you are. Essentially, the table serves the purpose of indicating to you the kinds of revenues that we've had over the course of the past many years, so that there's an understanding that we've already seen a contraction of resources in the Chancellor's office, which is appropriate as the three large institutions move out. What you see there is the assessments zeroed out.
Right.
So that's the key point. At this point, what we're suggesting, the proposal coming forward, is about $1 million over our expected state appropriation, and we recognize that there's process around that appropriation for FY15 and don't presume any particular outcome. At this point, we're simply putting forward our best recommendation to you about what it takes to do this work exceptionally well for FY15.
Great.
And that's where it ends. I don't have a proposal for you at this point.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I'm going to ask Chancellor Rose, and I'm going to give you a very open-ended question. Is there anything else you want this committee to know about the Chancellor's office and the long-term aspects of the Chancellor's office?
Well, Co-Chair Gerard, thank you very much for the generous question. You always ask me the hardest questions, and I appreciate that. I think most of what I need you to know has been already articulated today. We have an exceptional, talented group of people in the Chancellor's office. Fortunately, some who are transitioning out will be transitioning with shared services, so they have already found placement. A few others have left the organization already in order to pursue other opportunities. And I guess I would just ask for and thank you for what has already been expressed here, which is support of our expertise, support of our personnel, and some sensitivity around the difficulties of the transition. So I very much appreciate that.
I want morale to stay. I'm really concerned about morale at the Chancellor's office. So, anyway, any other questions at all? Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing and another informational hearing on shared academic services. Director Cannon, oh, that's tough to say. Director Henderson. Ben, how goes it?
Thank you, Chair Gerard. Members of the committee, and I think I have a few slides. I will be very brief. I know your time is short. For the record, Ben Cannon, I'm the Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. You'll note that I brought an audience. Former students or current students of the school where I used to work, the Arbor School, have been cycling in, and I thought I'd expose them to the scintillating work of the legislature here. Appreciate your indulgence. So I was asked, I think, to really pick up, actually, where Chancellor Rose and Director Donegan left off. The work of shared academic services does transition to the HEC during this biennium, and I'll just quickly walk through what some of those functions are. So, Andrew, if you don't mind, click to the next slide. So just a reminder, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is a coordinating, not a governing board. I can't state that too often. And very briefly, its core responsibilities are to advise and assist the OEIB on higher education goals, compacts, strategic investments, and data, to adopt a strategic plan for achieving higher education goals, to recommend to the governor and the OEIB, and ultimately through them to you, a consolidated higher education budget, including recommended appropriations to the various funding streams you see listed there, to determine how to allocate the appropriations that you provide to the HEC for those funding streams, to determine how to allocate them among and between institutions and students when it comes to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, to approve or disapprove proposed significant changes to academic programs at community colleges or universities, and just one more slide with this overview, to approve or disapprove mission statements of public universities, that we have a role in tuition approvals if they're proposed to be greater than 5% at public universities. There's the degree authorization and private career school licensing on the private side, and then a general requirement that we advise you and the governor and others on higher education issues and policies, and finally to respond to legislative requests on behalf of public universities for data, fiscal impacts, etc. So, very briefly, with the organizational structure that Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120 designed, the commission, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and its executive director, me, will oversee the various sort of agencies and offices listed here, so the Oregon Student Access Commission, CCWD, and then in purple are the real HEC-specific entities, the role for us to steer university academic coordination, the budget and funding coordination, the private post-secondary system, and to support that work through data and research. And just two more slides, I think. I'm going to focus on those, the ones in the box. So on academic coordination, what will we do? The HEC, as I noted, this small staff will have about 10 by the end of the, 10 in addition to myself by the end of the biennium. We'll be responsible inheriting this from the Chancellor's office of mission approvals for public universities, the program approvals, achievement compact measures, and a variety of articulation activities. And here's where I think there ought to be significant attention and concern to ensure that the good work of the State Board of Higher Ed, the State Board of Ed, the Joint Boards, the Joint Board Articulation Committee, and other entities that have been engaged in trying to knit together our higher education system continues. And so I've listed what some of the many topics of work there have been, and we will endeavor to continue Oregon's leadership in this regard. Go ahead. By way of note, although this you asked me to focus on the academic coordination, on budget and funding coordination, we'll be attempting to bring forward from the campuses their recommendations and integrate those recommendations around operations, capital, statewide public services, and strategic investments, and then, of course, the funding distribution authority that the HEC has starting July 1st, 2014. I think this is the final slide. And this is the point I probably want to underscore the most, which is to do this work well requires having data from the institutions, having the ability to evaluate and analyze that data, to audit it to ensure that it's accurate, and then to digest and present it to you and other decision makers, including the commission that I serve. We will endeavor to do so, again, with the resources that have been appropriated by this legislature to the HEC. We will be attempting to work with CCWD, the campuses, both community colleges and universities, to ensure that we have consistent, accurate, and relevant data in order to support all of the other work that I've described. I think I'll stop there. And
okay, we have a question, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Good seeing you. I'm trying to get my arms around this concept of it's a coordinating board, not a governing board. But then when I look at the slides, it talks about that you have the ability to approve or disapprove mission statements, approve or disapprove increases, authorize degrees, oversee licensing, et cetera. Help me understand the definition of coordinating versus the concept of governing.
Co-Chairs, Representative Smith, it's a good question, and I guess to do so, I'd draw on distinctions that are made really nationally, state by state, between coordinating boards, some systems have them, some don't, and governing boards. So the board that I serve will not have the authority, for example, to hire or fire an institutional president. It will not have the authority to adopt or even to change directly an institutionally adopted budget. So the campuses will be deciding how to spend the resources that are allocated to them. I think you've pointed at some areas where there's some gray and some shared responsibility, and it's interesting to note the fact that, for example, the HEC does not have the authority to approve or disapprove mission statements for community colleges. They retain that independence. But there was an interest in the legislature as we move forward with this restructuring through 270 and 3120 to ensure that there was a little more hands-on on the part of the state relative to the public university system, at least as expressed through mission statements. Program approval, it's identical, and I think that's consistent with coordinating boards in other states that are interested in, where a legislature and a governor is interested in ensuring that there isn't over-duplication of programs, that we're kind of rationalizing the work and basically not over-duplicating.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Any questions? Ben, I want to congratulate you on your appointment. I think you're stepping into a hornet's nest, I hope. I wish you the best. we'll see how you do.
It's already got great hair.
Exactly. I got some more questions.
Thank you. Enjoy being on this side of the Q&A. This is a bit of a follow-up to Representative Smith's question, and I think it does get into a gray area that hopefully we can navigate very skillfully, and that is, as we look at so many trends nationwide and here in Oregon on higher education. Most of them are towards higher cost, and so there's going to be tremendous financial pressures. And one of the great balances to that can be technology and adaptation of technology. And so I suspect this is going to be an ever greater theme facing our institutions. And of course, technology requires big investments. Given the greater autonomy that 270 provides, and then perhaps even more autonomy with more institutional boards, it raises the specter of redundant platforms and actually less collaboration, higher costs, particularly around these technology investments. And so it seems to me, as I look at the apparatus and the organizational charts, the opportunity for collaboration and actually kind of to certain degree, forcing collaboration, or at least encouraging collaboration, I don't know where else it rests besides with you. And some could interpret that as a governance function, but at the very least, somebody, I think, should be given very careful consideration to incentivize and collaboration you know, with community colleges and with universities so that we don't miss this opportunity.
Thank you. I've just, Matt and committee, it would be very difficult for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to compel a university or set of universities or community colleges to engage in a particular IT platform collectively, for example. That is not an authority that it appears the HEC directly has. However, I agree with your point, and I think that what the HEC can do is convene and cajole and attempt to persuade and potentially strategically fund a common, for example, and I realize it was just an example, but a common technology platform where that appears to be in the interest of the state and students.
Just one follow-up. Just that's exactly where I, as I've thought this through, having previously served on Oregon Inc., that was essentially the model there, was to fund strategic collaboratives. And so rather than compelling, you know, the heavy hand, what it was more saying is for the strategic investment, it really requires a level of collaboration, achieving economies of scale, and it worked.
Senator Jambro, you get a 30-second question.
Yeah, actually, it's not really a question, because I have to run and chair a task force myself. But, you know, since Andrea's here, Andrea, you know, I'm just wondering if you have anything to add from the community college. We've been talking about universities entirely today. From the community college perspective, in terms of where you see your future going within, you know, the HEC's shared services, shared academic services.
Yes, co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, executive director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I think from the community college perspective, we have a really high interest in making sure that the HEC succeeds, because there's specific functions that we need to have happen on the state level for the success of community colleges. As we started this whole process, the community colleges got together and tried to very explicitly define what it is we need to have happen on the academic side at the state level that's going to help us and community colleges at the local level to make sure that we're doing what's right for our students. And so some of that right now is at the HEC level. Some of it's at CCWD. I know as we go forward, trying to figure out how that's all going to kind of fit together is part of the challenge at this point. But certainly the academic approval of programs is essential at the state level. But beyond that, the role that the state can play to facilitate and convene around very specific issues is a piece that we need to have happen at the state level, so that as there's specific issues such as developmental ed, or for us, the Student Success Committee that we've had in the past, we need that state leadership to not tell us how to do it, but to convene and facilitate and perhaps put money behind to say, we think this is a point that's going to make the biggest difference for our student success, and how do we help convene and get the best minds at the table to say, this is what we need to have happen. And that's really a critical role. I know that there's, as we kind of are shifting through all these change and we move July 1 over to the HEC officially, how that all fits together I think is still kind of up in the air, but I think there's really critical roles that need to have happen, and really appreciate Ben's leadership to really kind of pull this all together and think about, you know, what are those services, what are those needs as we go forward. And one kind of last plug is we do want to make sure that there's the resources available at the HEC to support all of these academic needs so that we can make sure that our colleges are supported.
Okay, colleagues, I think we've kind of got an overview, and this is an arena that we really have to work on, and I think that there's nothing more important than coming up with a good solution. And hopefully it'll be something that we can agree on and is beneficial to everyone. I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I'm going to adjourn the meeting. And I'm going to adjourn the meeting.